This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The lobbying scandals and the Senate debate about lobbying reform have called attention to a Republican initiative known as the K Street Project, led by influential Republicans, including Grover Norquist and Tom DeLay, who won his Texas primary race yesterday. The K Street Project has pressured lobby groups to hire like-minded Republicans and support a conservative agenda. Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid called for an investigation into the project, describing it as having created a culture of corruption that has allowed political operatives like Jack Abramoff to flourish. With us to talk about the K Street Project is James Thurber. He's a distinguished professor of government and director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University. Thurber has testified on lobbying before the Senate Committee on Rules and Administration. What were the goals of the K Street Project when it was created?
The primary goals of the K Street Project were to make sure that people on K Street, that's where lobbyists are in Washington, D.C., and associations are there, that those associations and firms hire Republican staff members and former Republicans rather than Democrats. It was a way for the leadership, especially in the House of Representatives, to build a triangular relationship between the leadership in the House, Republican leadership, people on K Street that represented interests, and to gain a campaign contributions from those individuals in associations and firms that would go to Republicans to help them get reelected.
Now, the goal of the Republicans who started the K Street Project was, one of the goals was to make sure that the lobby groups hired Republicans in all of their staffing positions. My understanding is that the Republicans who organized the K Street Project not only wanted to make sure Republicans were hired, they wanted to make sure no Democrats were hired and that any Democrats who were on staff weren't on staff a whole lot longer. How did they go about doing that?
They had a list of people that they endorsed for jobs that of people leaving the Hill, and they also had a list of people who were loyal, of course, in the Republican Party that were members of the House and the Senate. And you should know that 43% of the members of the House and the Senate since 1998 have become lobbyists. And so the Democrats that left didn't fare as well as the Republicans. There were some very visible fights over Tom DeLay telling associations that they needed to hire a Republican rather than a Democrat. I will not go through the list, but they were well known here in Washington, D.C. And the message went out that if you really wanted to be effective in terms of access and influence on Capitol Hill, you better hire a Republican as the head of an association or in the firm. Yes, Democrats were there, but you better have a whole lot of Republicans. And that fit into the campaign finance area in the sense that those individuals then were asked to bring in a certain amount of money to help the Republicans. There was a great deal of loyalty in the relationship.
So the leadership of the K Street Project wanted lobby groups to hire only Republicans in new positions or in replacement positions. Were the lobby groups punished in any way if they didn't go along, and if they hired a Democrat or if they hired a Republican who wasn't considered a Republican that had signed on to the program?
If a lobby firm that was hired for contract lobbying, that's different than an association, didn't really clean up its act quickly enough, in other words, bring in more Republicans or fire some Democrats, they were locked out. They were not able to go in and talk to the chairs. They were not able to talk to the leadership about what they wanted. If they wanted an earmark, a special spending program for a narrow project in there for a client, they were not allowed really in to talk to the Republican subcommittee chairs of appropriation. So it was quite effective. And the discipline was phenomenal in terms of making sure that that happened.
Several of our guests have pointed out that lobbyists have taken a more active role in actually writing legislation than ever before. What role, if any, did the K Street Project play in that?
Lobbyists have always had influence in writing legislation. They lobby to have provisions put into legislation. They actually have entire bills that they give to members. Of course, only members can introduce them. The K Street Project placed people with great expertise from the Hill in lobbying positions, people who used to help draft legislation for members or actually the members themselves. And so with that expertise, they were able to draft amendments and legislation and give them to members and to staff members on the Hill to consider. And in effect, they were writing the legislation. It was being introduced by people still working on the Hill. And because they had such close relationships, they, in effect, were writing the bills before they were introduced.
Well, what's in it for legislators to let lobbyists write the bills that the legislators should be writing? Is it money?
Well, I think that the primary reason that happens is that people get very busy on the Hill. Staff do, members do. And if there's a trust relationship, a reciprocal trust relationship with someone who's a lobbyist, that saves them a great deal of time. They know that they trust the judgment of that individual, and so that they will take that draft and they'll look at it, maybe take it to legislative council, have it reviewed, and then they'll introduce it. They'll introduce it because they don't have time to draft it themselves. They don't have enough expertise in a particular area, and it helps them immensely.
Do you have a favorite example of a piece of legislation that was really written by lobbyists?
Well, the earmarking process is really, in many cases, legislation written by people off the Hill that are lobbying for a very narrow project for a state or a corporation or a congressional district. The actual language gets written by a lobbyist. It's sent up during the lobbying process, handed to people. And last time there were thousands of these earmarks for $53 billion in the last cycle of spending. And that doesn't include tax earmarks and authorization earmarks.
You want to explain what earmarks are?
Yes, earmarks are, it refers to agriculture in the United States where there's a little tag on the ear of a cow or a pig or sheep to say who owns it. An earmark in the legislative process is a provision, obscure, non-transparent, that's written into an appropriation bill or a tax bill or an authorization bill to say that a particular thing must happen, and that thing is, let's say, fund two bridges in Alaska to nowhere or a bunch of projects for West Virginia. And in the case there, Stevens from Alaska was chairman of the Appropriations Committee, and he had a lot of earmarks for projects in Alaska in the surface transportation bill. Senator Robert C. Byrd earmarks things for West Virginia without any deliberation, any transparency, without a vote. It just gets added, and added sometimes at the conference stage. That means the bill under consideration has passed the House and the Senate. It goes to a conference, and they have to make sure that the bill is identical for the House and the Senate, so they have a conference between the House and the Senate. There are earmarks that are added to the conference bill that have not been considered in the House or the Senate, written by lobbyists, to have specific provisions for universities, for roads, for corporations, and they just get included at late at night in a non-transparent way. Now, the House and the Senate want to do something about this, and we'll see in the future whether they will try to limit those kinds of earmarks. It looks like they will.
Let's get back to the K Street Project. Who were the founders of it?
The founders of the K Street Project were the leaders of the Contract with America that were elected in the 1994 election. In 1995, the Republicans took over the House of Representatives, and Newt Gingrich was the face of the K Street Project in the House of Representatives. And shortly thereafter, the later majority leader, Tom DeLay, took over the K Street Project. The idea started off of the Hill by conservatives in the Republican Party that said, hey, wait a minute. When you look around Washington, all the lobbyists seem to be Democrats. That doesn't make sense. We're in power now. We need to have Republicans in K Street connecting with Republicans on the Hill. So it started in 1995, but it also, in some ways, has been around for many, many years because anyone in power who is leaving the Hill and wants to stay in Washington, D.C., thinks about the possibility of lobbying, including staff members as well as members of the House and the Senate. And so there has been an informal network of trying to hire people off the Hill into associations, into lobbying firms, because they know a lot about the Hill, they have a lot of friends, and that's been going on for 30, 40 years.
Now, Grover Norquist was also, or is also, one of the leaders of the K Street Project. Grover Norquist is the head of Americans for Tax Reform. He's been close to President Bush, is my understanding, and has led weekly, very influential meetings of conservatives. What has his role been in the K Street Project?
Grover Norquist claims he is the creator of the K Street Project. I'm uncomfortable saying that it was only Grover Norquist. I think that there were staff members on the Hill associated with Newt Gingrich that also had some influence on that. Grover Norquist is a very conservative Republican, especially on taxes, and he felt that if you were going to push his agenda of cutting taxes, starve the beast, as he says, cut off money, resources to the federal government because he thinks large government is bad, the best way to approach that, he said, is to starve the power of Democratic lobbyists on K Street, or any lobbyist that didn't go along with that agenda. So he then and to this day has had some influence on the K Street Project. He likes it. Yes, he's close to the president, President Bush. He's close to the leadership in the House. He has made certain public statements that have embarrassed people lately, so he's somewhat less important as he was, say, 2 years ago.
Now, what pressure could he put on lobby groups to play ball? You know, he's not a congressman. He's not writing legislation. He's not voting on legislation.
Grover Norquist put pressure and still attempts to put pressure on associations and lobbying firms in town by his influence through the Speaker and the leadership of the House of Representatives, in particular, less so in the Senate, and by his reputed relationship with Karl Rove, who is assistant to the president that's very powerful, and to the president himself. By using that reputation of relationship, he had more power, and he could subtly say, and therefore sometimes threaten associations if they didn't hire somebody. He certainly would let other people know that that was a problem. And in fact, there are some cases where he's done so.
What has Senator Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania's role been in the K Street Project?
Senator Santorum has been closely related to the K Street Project. He's been an organizer of it in the House. He's now in the Senate. This has become a problem for him, so he's backed off of it. He's on the Senate Rules Committee, and he in fact, backed the idea of, quote, banning the K Street Project. And one of the reasons for this, of course, is he's in a very tough race in Pennsylvania, and he has been accused of cronyism and ethical lapses as a result of the K Street Project.
So he's now talking about banning the K Street Project, but how much of a part of it has he been?
I think he's been a central part of the K Street Project. He helped have regular meetings of the Republicans where they would pass around a list of people who were leaving the Hill, and that they would bring in lobbyists from K Street to be in those meetings on the Senate side on federal property to talk about how can you help out Mr. Smith and how can you help out Ms. Smith because they're leaving and they're loyal staffers up here. We like them. How can you find a position for them? He played a key role in making that linkage through regular meetings with lobbyists and producing a list of people that they endorsed for jobs on K Street.
The new House Majority Leader, John Boehner of Ohio, who replaced Tom DeLay, campaigned for Majority Leader on the promise that if he were elected, there would be no K Street Project or anything else like it. Has he made any moves in that direction of eliminating anything like the K Street Project?
Majority Leader Boehner, when he was running for the office, and it was a very competitive situation, was all for many reforms, not only banning the K Street Project, but curbing excessive privately funded travel, slowing the revolving door of members, strengthening oversight and enforcement and disclosure. The day he was elected and he came forward, he had a transformational experience. All of a sudden, he wasn't for reform anymore, and he felt that things were pretty good and that they really didn't need to have a lot of reform. That is a battle going on inside the House of Representatives now. Those who feel that they need to have reform and those in the power structure that seem to be backing off of reform. The K Street Project is part of that. We have not heard anything from the House about banning the K Street Project from the leadership.
What's left of the K Street Project now? I mean, there's been major investigations into lobbying. Tom DeLay, who was one of the leaders of the K Street Project, is no longer House Majority Leader. So have the investigations into lobbying made it more difficult for the K Street Project to operate?
The scandal and the individuals breaking the law and going to jail and the ethical lapses, if you want to call them that, by members, staff, and lobbyists in Washington have changed the environment of lobbying. And one of the aspects of changing the environment of lobbying is I think the K Street Project is very weak, if not broken. There are no longer regular meetings on Capitol Hill where you have the K Street Project as a agenda item and you're talking about placing people in jobs. And that's not because there's a ban. That's just because members aren't doing it anymore. And there are many firms who were fundamentally influenced by the K Street Project. That's not changing rapidly, but the firms feel, I think, more freedom to hire the best person, say, on trade policy rather than the best Republican on trade policy. And I see some indications then that the K Street Project is really broken, and it's certainly very weak. And it's broken and weak because of all of the scandals surrounding lobbying, which ultimately pointed to the K Street Project.
You know, we hear a lot about the revolving door, that a lot of congressmen and senators who leave office end up in the lobbying world because the worlds work together, and the expertise and influence that they have as ex-lawmakers would serve them very well as lobbyists. But you've pointed out that the revolving door works the other way, too, that a lot of lobbyists end up running for office. In fact, you made a list of how many people currently in the House or Senate are former lobbyists. So what's the answer? How many?
At this point, there are at least 12 individuals who used to be lobbyists that are now members of Congress. And beyond that, there are literally dozens of senior congressional staff that used to be lobbyists that are senior staff. And then beyond that, they leave the Hill and they go back to the lobbying firms or associations. So the revolving door is two ways. It's on the Hill and it's off the Hill. And I think this is a problem.
Why?
I think it's a problem because these are public servants. These are people who should represent the wider public, and there's a question of conflict of interest. There's a question of trust in the institution. If people think that these individuals are representing narrow special interests that they represented before they get to the Hill, an example of a former lobbyist that became a senator is Senator Thune from South Dakota, a Republican. Who represented railroad interests before he came to the Senate. He introduced very focused and narrow provisions to help a particular railroad out in South Dakota, but other railroads, in a larger surface transportation bill when he was in the Senate. And it was almost identical to what he was doing in terms of advocating before he got to the Senate. I think there's a problem there. I think that there is a conflict of interest. He had, in fact, in my opinion, an economic stake personally in this because he was making hundreds of thousands of dollars representing the railroads before he got into Congress. And I'm sure that there was a feeling of reciprocity and obligation to those interests after he got in. He wasn't representing a wider public, the public interest, when doing this. I think that's a problem.
There's a law that says a legislator has to wait a certain amount of time before leaving office and becoming a lobbyist. Is there any reverse law that regulates how long a lobbyist has to wait before becoming a lawmaker?
There's a waiting period of 1 year for members and senior staff in Congress before they can become a lobbyist. And there is no waiting period in that revolving door from being a lobbyist to become a legislator. Some people have talked about regulating that. I doubt very much if that will happen in the near future. In fact, there's no legislation pending with respect to that.
Lobbyists have been playing a bigger role in campaigning. I think you touched a little bit on how they've been doing that, but could you expound on that a little bit?
There's this gray area in American politics, and a lot of people don't know about it, and that is where campaign professionals become lobbyists, or they're lobbyists at the same time that they're campaign specialists. And it happens especially with the money. You work for a candidate, you work very hard to get them elected, you get very close to that candidate, and then after the election, there is a period where there's no campaigns going on and you have to do something as a professional, and you become an advocate of policies from industry or for unions, because people know that you're close to that candidate and they hire you to pitch the candidate on what they want. Or sometimes during the campaign they hire you at the same time that the candidate hires you. It's really a shade of gray, and there's very little regulation with respect to it. Many times campaign specialists are also the heads of political action committees for members. They're the treasurers as well as lobbyists. It's a world that people know in Washington. It's not a world that's written about very much, and most people don't know about it outside of Washington.
Republican Senator Susan Collins and Democratic Senator Joe Lieberman had proposed the creation of an Office of Public Integrity. What was their goal in proposing this, and what was the outcome?
The Office of Public Integrity proposal was there so that there would be more rigorous enforcement of existing law and ethics related to lobbying and also member behavior. It was a direct insult to the chair of the Ethics Committee in the Senate, Mr. Voinovich, a Republican from Ohio, but also the chair of the Ethics Committee in the House of Representatives, Doc Hastings, a Republican from the state of Washington. They felt they were doing a good job. Most people feel they were not doing a good job. They needed to create another institution that was objective, bipartisan, that had the resources to enforce existing law and to review travel and to have more transparency in the system. The old guard in the Senate didn't like it, and Collins, chair of the Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee, where the jurisdiction is over this issue, proposed it. Lieberman, ranking on that committee, was for it. He's a Democrat. We thought we had bipartisan support, but they lost overwhelmingly in committee. It has come up on the floor of the Senate again in the form of several amendments. It looks like it will fail.
What do you think the odds are that when the Senate and the House finally come together and agree on a bill for lobbying that will be a lobbying reform bill with teeth?
I think the probability is that we're going to have lobbying reform light this year. And that means they're not going to do very much. They're going to ban people that were members, former members that are now lobbyists from the gym. They've already done that in the House, or from the floor privileges. That has nothing to do with the problems that we have here. I think they're going to do very little in terms of enforcement, strengthening oversight, enhancing disclosure of lobbying, let alone curbing privately funded travel and gifts. I hope that we have reform, but I don't think we're going to have significant reform.
You want significant lobbying reform, but do you think there is a place where lobbying actually helps the American democracy?
Lobbying is not a bad word in my mind. I have lots of friends that are lobbyists. We have First Amendment rights here in this democracy. We have the right of assembly, to petition government, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion. These things allow for the growth of groups. They allow for the growth of people who advocate particular positions. In fact, you can organize around anything in America as long as it's not a terrorist organization like Al-Qaeda or the Communist Party or Hamas. In fact, if you're a mother who tragically has lost a son in an accident caused by a drunken driver, you can create Mothers Against Drunk Driving in your local community, and it can spread to the county, the state, and nationally and have an impact on the recent surface transportation bill. I think that's right. That's the nature of our pluralist representative democracy. It's what makes it great. If there are people who have a particular grievance, they can organize and lobby. The problem is that we need more transparency, we need more oversight, we need to strengthen the existing enforcement of lobbying laws, and we need to cut out really excessive contributions from very wealthy people and corporations in terms of privately funded travel and gifts and other things that members are getting.
James Thurber, thank you very much for talking with us.
Yes, thank you.
James Thurber is a distinguished professor of government and director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University.